on exports of fish, timber, and mining. And we heard testimony earlier that those shipping industries affiliated with the shipping of natural resources are currently not very not doing very well. And I just wanted to make the point that it is an income tax, and an income tax is often regarded as the fairest tax because it doesn't tax until an entity is making money. The fiscal impact, you have a fiscal note in front of you indicating that we believe the revenue involved is between 3 and 8 million. We have to say that this is a very sketchy information. We have put together an analysis of several of the industries impacted from public records and some information from current tax returns. But we are certainly looking for additional information, and I would certainly invite any of the folks who testified here today to provide us with any actual numbers. I haven't heard much in the way of real dollar effects, and we know that there may be an impact with for example, shipping coal, but we don't know if it's going to be cents per ton or dollars per ton or tenths of cents per ton. We have no idea the order of magnitude. So that's the extent of my testimony. If I'd be happy to answer any questions that folks might have.
Just before we go to Representative Cotter, just put that in perspective. I thought you said the Anita was collecting 300 million, or did I hear that wrong?
I'm sorry?
Anita was collecting 300 million now?
Yes, that's and about right. It's
70 was oil?
70 from oil and 50 from...
You said
from
50, then you went to 50 million.
What? 50 million from everything other than oil.
Well, then what's 300 less, what, 270 is 30.
Well, right? It's... It's 330 million? Is that... no, 320 million. If you add the 50 and the 270. I'm sorry.
I forgot. Most people in government round off to the...
Oh, right.
20 yeah, million here or there. You know.
I can give you the exact number, sir. Okay, right.
I'm sorry, I came from the private sector.
The oil and gas corporate income tax in FY97 collected $269,783,582. The other corporations paid $49,610,974.
Okay, so putting in perspective here, upwards to 3 to 8 million, so we could have as much as a... 10% increase in non-oil related companies?
I'd say that's 1%.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. No. Oh, 10% of the others.
Oh, of the non-oil gas. Yeah.
In other words, the other
3 million as to 300 million is 1%.
Yeah. So, I mean, let's say in that range around 5 million.
That's
correct. 3 to 8, around 10%.
10%. Yeah, that'd be good.
Okay. Representative Cotter.
Yeah, you sort of got through it early, but I missed it. What's unique about Alaska's tax law that would justify a decision, the interpretation given by the court?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Cowdery, Alaska's, what the court held is that the apportionment method of taxation is theoretically different from the United States, and so that the tax policy of the United States wouldn't be automatically incorporated into state law, and that in this case the court found that it doesn't. Now, other states have apportionment, and other states haven't found that, but other states, I haven't seen another court case in another state. I don't know that it's been, hasn't been through court. Most states, as we've heard, either actually have a piece of legislation that incorporates 883 into their statutory structure, or have simply taken the position that the federal provision is incorporated and have not taxed. And so we would be pioneers.
Further questions, Ms. Moore? Representative Ryan, and I have a couple.
Well, just a reference I made to Barclays, you're absolutely correct that that was on a worldwide income, but the repercussions, according to the articles in Economist magazine, where the Prime Minister of Great Britain was talking about dumping all the reciprocal tax treaties with the United States, and they weren't the only ones. A lot of people got on the bandwagon. So this sort of thing can lead to lots of nastiness, and I don't really know if it's necessary. We do these sort of things.
Hey, Ms. Willett, could you, just real quickly here, could you tell the committee when the MTC, as the court used, was adopted here in the state of Alaska, that section of the law, roughly?
I believe the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act was adopted before statehood.
Okay.
It's certainly been the law.
I'll double check that. And another kind of a technical question. I'm looking at the section involved by this very bill, which is 43.20.021A. It says in the footnote that this was a 1987 amendment to subsection A. First sentence substituted sections 26 U.S.C. 1 through 1399 and 601 da 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 Internal Revenue Code, which substituted for Subtitle F and Chapter 1 of Subtitle A of the 1954 Internal Revenue Code, Public Law, da 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 da, et cetera, et cetera, and these other things. My point is, the reason I'm reading you a footnote is probably remind you of something you know very well, is when was 883 adopted into Alaska statutes by that sentence?
Mr. Chairman,
thank you very much.
I'm not sure when the federal government adopted Section 883, but the amendment that you're referring to in 1987 simply took out the references to subtitles and so on in the Internal Revenue Code and cited the actual sections that were incorporated.
I guess what I'm looking for is any help from you folks about when 883 was or wasn't adopted under this Alaska tax scheme.
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that specifically because I don't think that the legislature has specifically addressed that. The legislature has incorporated large parts of the code into Alaska statutes, and our court has traditionally looked at Alaska's tax policy to decide which of those broadly incorporated provisions it would find are actually incorporated. There's lots of those in the general incorporation that we don't follow, like interest. The legislature has separately set an interest rate for Alaska, procedural
that's
provisions.
That's because they've accepted or modified.
That's right, and that's what the court held here was that
That's what I'm getting at. That's what I was trying to determine what the legislative history was by these various things. It's kind of hard because some of it really goes back a long ways. I'm just trying to piece that together. I thought you maybe would help us. Maybe we can talk to you with outside the committee hearing on that particular issue. And one final point for myself. The letters that we have in the bill packet from the Department of Treasury and U.S. State Department regarding the reciprocity, retaliation, and the national policy of discouraging subnational taxation of foreign companies, which are treaty obligations between the U.S. government and these national governments. Aren't we injecting ourselves here in international trade? And aren't we doing something that, as a matter of policy nationally, is against the national policy in terms of international trade and international relations?
Mr. Chairman, that certainly is a policy argument that the legislature will want to consider. There have been arguments, for example, that motor fuel tax applied to international air carriers would violate those treaties, and the United States Supreme Court has ruled that state taxation is not preempted by those treaties. So it's quite clear that we have the freedom to adopt our own policy. We have not heard from the State Department. Someone else may have, but the Department of Revenue has not heard from the State Department since that decision came down, and I'm not sure what their current position would
be. We'll find out for you. And any other questions that we'd like to go on? Representative Ryan?
I have a question. If this legislature adopts a section of the IRS code, do we also accept various private letter rulings that go along with that from the first state?
Through the chair, Representative Ryan, the Internal Revenue Code regulations are certainly looked to by our Revenue Department, and letter rulings and interpretations are often become a part of the way we apply our law. Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ms. Boat. We look forward to working with you on this, and I appreciate the governor's stance and listening to what if people want, and I understand that, and I do appreciate that without making a preconceived judgment on this. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Next, we'd like to hear from Ms. Susan Berkley. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Berkley.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, my name is Susan Burke. I'm an attorney here in Juneau, and I represent the Northwest Cruise Ship Association, primarily as a lawyer, but they did ask me to come to the hearing today in case you had any questions. And by way of background, the Northwest Cruise Ship Association participated in the OSG bulk ships case as a friend of the court or amicus curiae, which means that they filed a brief in support of the position that OSG was taking in the case. The Alaska Visitors, and I did not represent Northwest Cruise Ship in that endeavor, but I did represent the Alaska Visitors Association, who also filed a friend of the court amicus curiae brief in that case. So I have some familiarity with the issues, and I think when this legislation came up, it was sort of logical to find someone in Juneau who had some familiarity, and I was she, so here I am.
Well, very good. We're glad to have your expertise, ma'am.
Thank you. In terms of the policy issues, I don't have much to add. I mean, you've heard a lot of testimony from an amazingly wide array of business interests throughout the state, and they pretty much said it all. I do feel a certain sense of deja vu because I was here working for the IBM Corporation in 1991 and 92, trying to persuade the legislature to adopt the Water's Edge legislation and prohibit the Department of Revenue from continuing to require the worldwide combination. And and you know, questions, you know, arose as well. You know, it doesn't technically violate any international treaties and so forth. But by the same token, I think that you really have to take a close look when you hear as many diverse industries telling you how important it is that you, in effect, maintain the status quo here. As Ms. Vogt said, they've never actively collected this tax. We aren't talking about money that you have on the table today that you're not going to have on the table tomorrow or next year if you fail to pass this legislation. So having said that, I can answer. I'm not a technical tax lawyer, I have to tell you that, but I'll answer any questions I can.
Oh, well. I do have a couple of things, and number one, could you tell us, and I neglected to ask Ms. Vogt about that, about the effective date of the bill going back to retroactivity?
1993?
Right, January 1, 93. What is the effect of that, and why would that be the date?
That's the date because, primarily because of the, to some extent, the statute of limitations. And in order to maintain the status quo, if you will, which is to say that the 883 exemption applies in Alaska. I mean, industry has taken the position from the word go that the legislature always intended this exemption to apply under the Alaska Income Tax Act, and it was simply the Department of Revenue's interpretation of that early legislative intent that differed from that. So there's been a dispute for some period of time. The Alaska Supreme Court resolved it in favor of the Department of Revenue with the greatest respect for the court. I think they were wrong. I mean, I in my own view believe that the legislature intended that provision to always have been in the law. And now I've forgotten your question. I'm so sorry.
No, what was the effective date? What the impact that
was? Oh, and the impact of it. It simply I don't know that it has any particular impact, except that it makes sure that the decision, there isn't a window of time during which the decision would have effect, and then no longer any effect in the future. So we're simply taking it back and maintaining the status quo back to a reasonable date, I guess is what it amounts to. I mean, conceivably, there may be some taxpayer out there who will be very unhappy if they signed a statute of limitations waiver that goes back earlier than 1993. But for the most part, I think that seemed like a reasonable time to capture all of those instances.
Ms. Burke, you said you were around here. You were in Gino and involved in the legislature at that time when they adopted the new tax law provisions. There was also another bill that was discussed in 1991. Trying to get the right number here. House Bill 12. This was for a specific act or bill adopting this, excluding Section 883.
That's
as
correct.
It related to water vessels only. And I have a quote that I'd like to read for the record from the House Finance Committee at that time, and I'm going to ask if you can remember some of this. This is the official record of the House Finance Committee on that. It says, Representative Ulmer stated she would not support the proposed CS because the philosophy was inconsistent with the intent of the bill. She thought the original bill was intended to send a message that Alaska is a friendly business climate for foreign investors. The original bill changed the worldwide apportionment to the water's edge method, like all other states. With the adoption of the proposed CS, and this is House Bill 12, Alaska would now be the only state not having the exemption, and she's talking about the 883 exemption, to the federal code. That means the lieutenant governor went on record in support of, like, this particular legislation in 1991. Do you remember what happened about on House Bill 12 and the discussions?
Yeah, I don't remember the exact numbers. The issue came up during the discussions and consideration of the Water's Edge legislation, and there was there was an attempt to amend the Water's Edge legislation to remove the Section 883 exemption from the Alaska income tax. Eventually, the issues were split off, and the Water's Edge bill was allowed to go off on its own without that provision in it. But there was a good deal of discussion in the legislature about that, and a bill was introduced, as you mentioned, that it just dealt with the water carriers at that point. And it not only was it never enacted, there was a great deal of testimony from a number of legislators throughout the hearing process about what a bad idea it would be. And you've heard a lot of those same reasons here today. It's still a bad idea.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Burke. It also, when you were doing your amicus brief, did you look at any legislative histories for the adoption of the tax and the various other reforms?
I certainly did, and I was unable to find anything useful. It's just too early. I mean, it's really only been in the last 20 years that the legislature has kept the kinds of records that we have, tape recordings and documentation and so on. And I was unable to find anything directly on point.
As a long-time observer of the legislature,
pardon?
As a long-time observer of the legislature, wouldn't you think it would be unusual that it's not unusual that there may not be a lot of discussion when a group of Alaskan legislators are adopting by reference some other federal law? I mean, do you think it would be surprising if there wasn't a lot of discussion?
I would be awfully surprised if in the course of adopting the entire Internal
Right.
Revenue Code that people would unless there were particular concerns about it, that a section would be brought up. I mean, I would think that if there were concerns about it, you'd have a specific provision in the statute saying we don't want Section 883 adopted as part of our code, but those arguments, I think, were probably made to the Alaska Supreme Court, and we have the decision now. I mean, I don't know what will happen on rehearing. It's unusual for the court to reverse itself on rehearing, but...
What's the rehearing? Could you explain to the committee for the record what
the process is?
Process.
Very soon after the Supreme Court decides a case, it's possible for the losing party to file a petition for rehearing asking the court to reconsider the decision. The grounds are very narrow. It's whether they have totally overlooked some material fact or overlooked some salient legal point, which is to say not even considered it. It's unusual for those petitions to be granted, but it's been known to happen.
Very good. Further questions, Ms. Berg? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Vogt, a question regarding the effective date.
Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Vogt, for the record, regarding the effective date, was Ms. Burke's testimony correct, or do you want to elaborate on how you would do that procedurally?
Mr. Chairman, the effective date provision did catch my eye. One thing about it is that normally, and I believe your legislative drafting manual asks that if a provision is on retroactivity is in a piece of legislation, then it should have an immediate effective date. And I did notice that the legislation does not have an immediate effective date. In terms of retroactive effect, I believe we've spoken previously, but not on the record, about the fact that the department is faced when folks have not previously filed tax returns with the question of how far back should the department go. And that's one of the areas in which we do have some discretion. As I earlier testified, I believe the court has now told us what the law is, and we don't have any discretion about whether or not to apply the law the way the court has told us it reads. But there is a question about whether to go back with folks who haven't previously filed, and the retroactive provisions in the legislation would address that and foreclose us from going back. I think, as Ms. Burke testified, the intent would be to, if you do adopt it from this day forward, to prohibit the enforcement of the provision in past years.
Given the time you've had to consider this now, would that be an appropriate effective date to January 1st, 1993, if that were to be the policy adopted? Do you have a preference or what?
Mr. Chairman, I would really prefer the Department of Law's testimony on that. I certainly think as a matter of policy, it's up to the legislature how you want your legislation to apply. I'm not sure whether there are legal issues in going back that far. Normally, when you adopt any change to the corporate income tax, you make it effective either the January 1 of the year that you're in or the January 1 of the year, well, tax years, either that are current during the legislation or for the prospective tax year.
Yes, but hasn't it been your testimony that you either didn't enforce it as or got waivers, so didn't collect this tax for a number of years?
That's correct.
So, I mean,
it would affect
the prospect of it. The court decision going the other way was, I understood, 50-50, and maybe one reason why you opted not to do that, and therefore, if I'm correct there, and then if you could speak to that, and then going back, would that not be a rational thing to do, or what now?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know what the various departments since 1987 have thought the odds of prevailing in the OSG litigation might be. But I did testify that we have not affirmatively sought compliance with our interpretation of the exemption, the 883 exemption. There are a few tax cases that a retroactive effective date would affect. Those cases that we have either assessments or waivers, they're not many. There are a few.
You know, it'd be nice to know how many waived and how many you've tried to enforce. could you provide the committee and or the legislature with some idea about how many fit either category?
To the extent that I can without breaching taxpayer confidentiality, I'd be happy to.
I appreciate that. Just in terms of numbers there, without, obviously, you don't, wouldn't want to be breach of privacy, but that might be helpful in it, you know. And also, you didn't seem to indicate your understanding about prior rationale. Is there a written or policy within the department about how you handle this provision? Or how do you go about making those decisions?
Mr. Chairman, our policies are enacted into regulations. It doesn't do us a lot of good to have internal policies about the tax laws, since the court will strike them as invalid regulations.
Right, but you must have had a policy about this 883. So was that in reg?
I mean,
that's what I'm saying.
I mean, there is no regulation, and I would hesitate to speak for the last 10 years. Certainly, this controversy that was working its way up through the courts has come to my attention during my tenure at the Department of Revenue, and it has seemed appropriate to continue the course that had already been set, that to wait and see what the court did.
It's kind of an unwritten policy of the department, or what? Or was it on the back of the graffiti on the back door of the bathroom or something?
I guess you'd say it's an unwritten policy.
Okay. We're waiting for a number of member, and with that, we'll take an at ease right now. I know. Representative Cotter.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to move House Bill 472 out of the committee with the individual recommendation with the company zero fiscal note.
Well, it's not a zero fiscal.
Well, with the company fiscal note.
And individual recommendation.
Are there individual recommendation.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so moved. Next, we will, the House Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned at 5:27. Thank you very much, everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, gentlemen. Jerry, you remind me. I got too many things in mind, but I will.